This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chiatakis. All right, let's leave the hubbub of the metropolis and go north now for some rolling golden hills dotted with oak trees. While most of the hilltops are bare, one could be a cousin of Mount Olympus. Splashing fountains fill a marble-lined swimming pool fit for the gods. In fact, a 17th-century statue of Neptune is the lifeguard on duty, keeping an eye on the water from the top of a temple. You know where we are, don't you?
To me, it is one of the most recognizable pools in the world. Every person that comes up on a tour here visits this pool and the Roman pool.
That's right. It's Hearst Castle. And Dan Fallett with California State Parks is talking about the incomparable Neptune Pool. The Central Coast Sanctuary of publishing tycoon William Randolph Hearst is now celebrating its 100th anniversary. But it's 2 years late. After a long COVID closure, a freak storm in 2021 washed out part of the road up to the estate, tacking on a second year of solitude. Well, now it's finally back open, and the castle is celebrating Julia Morgan, California's first licensed female architect and the designer of this sprawling estate. KCRW's Matt Gillum took a trip up to San Simeon to see the castle and learn more about the woman behind one man's dream.
The drive south from the Bay Area to Hearst Castle isn't short. It's about 230 miles, the same distance if you're driving up from L.A. But Suzanne Miller and her husband weren't intimidated.
I'm a huge Julia Morgan fan. I grew up kind of like seeing the stuff that she built in the Bay Area, and I had never seen down here, and he's been a lot, so we just kind of jumped in the car and came down.
Miller says her first trip to La Cuesta Encantada, the Enchanted Hill, as Hearst formally named his mansion, has sparked a deeper interest in the architect.
I think it's kind of interesting how hodgepodge the house is in terms of like architecture and art, and that's what makes me a little more curious about it, was her kind of like putting together designs that were acquired from elsewhere.
William Randolph Hearst collected nearly every sort of art or antiquity under the sun, but through a collaboration that spanned 28 years, he and Morgan made an estate that integrated his boundless artifacts with a, for its time, thoroughly modern home. Here at the poolside temple, you can see architect Julia Morgan's subtle mastery of blending old and new. Hearst had some of the elements, like the ancient columns holding up Neptune, but a lot of improvising was necessary. Guide Catherine Keller takes us into the shade of a colonnade.
This was part of Morgan's way of working with Hearst. There would be historic elements like the columns there that date back to Roman era, 1st to 4th century AD, and then fragments of other various Roman buildings up on top. But where you had a gap, you would have the craftsmen step in, cast some nice concrete that would look marble-like, and they could finish out the temple facade.
As for the 345,000-gallon Neptune pool, California State Parks Dan Fallett, who's along for the tour, advises against accidentally falling in.
What happens to pool violators?
They will definitely be taken down the hill in free transportation, issued a citation, and or, depending on how severe it is, it could go further than that. But, you know, we try to dissuade everybody from doing that.
In other words, best not to make a splash.
We're taking a side entrance in. We're now in the castle.
Julia Morgan was what's known as a client's architect. You'd hire her, she'd listen, and turn your vision into a place. In this case, the client had acquired a massive fireplace and needed a room to house it, along with a collection of tapestries. Hearst
wrote to Miss Morgan and said, you know, I've been able to purchase the Barney mantle. And he said, I know you'll build a room to receive it. A year and a half later, Hearst wrote back to Morgan, the mantle is up, and it is G-R-E-A-T, all caps, great. It is none too large for the room.
The assembly room, which Morgan designed around that hulking mantle, is one of many examples of the partnership between Morgan and Hearst. In fact, she described him as the castle's co-architect, in no small part because they were in
constant communication. 1,000 letters we have in our archives sent between Hearst and Morgan, letters and telegrams, and another 9,000 between their staffs.
Along with frequent correspondence, Morgan also made numerous trips to San Simeon to oversee construction. She didn't exactly run in the same circles as Hearst's guests, who included literary, political, and movie stars.
You know, Julia Morgan was a selfie-facing, skinny woman who wore tweed skirts that were inches too long. She wore no makeup. And in the dining room in the evening, She looked like a neat bantam hen next to birds of paradise. And yet, she always had the seat of honor.
The place settings on the long table in the refectory are elaborate, but something sticks out.
Paper napkins, much more sanitary. His mother did pass in 1919, the Spanish flu. And so Hearst was aware of some of the things we've all become very aware of in the last 2 years. And his companion, Marion Davies, with whom he entertained up here, said it saved nicely on the laundry bill.
The delayed centennial tour at Hearst Castle showcasing Morgan includes more than the grand rooms on one of the standard tours. In the studio-style apartments that make up the north duplexes, displays on the wall spotlight Morgan's young life and early career. Not only did she graduate from Berkeley in 1894 with an engineering degree, but she was the first woman to be admitted to the architecture program at the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris at the close of the 19th century.
So when the news came back that she had won a place at the Beaux-Arts, of course it hit the front page of the Examiner, and her father did say, it seems as if I might go down in history as the father of the distinguished architect Julia Morgan.
How right he was. California's first licensed female architect designed more than 700 projects. In 2014, more than half a century after her death, she was awarded her profession's highest honor, a gold medal from the American Institute of Architects. Back outside, we take in the whole vista, Neptune Pool, the mansion, and the Santa Lucia Mountains. Dan Fallett with State Parks says what we're looking at is essentially unchanged from when Hearst was entertaining here and Morgan was building.
I mean, this is a world-class art museum surrounded by some of the best architecture and the highest level of design that Miss Morgan and Mr. Hearst were able to create. So it's an amazing place to just be enveloped by it.
Even though it's only been a few hours, there's an intimacy that comes with seeing the ins and outs of somebody's house and guest houses. That's the goal.
My approach, and I think as Catherine and all my staff approaches, you know, we want you to experience what it would have been like as a guest of Mr. Hearst. So everybody takes a different sense of what is special to them. The sights and sounds of looking at the ocean, the breeze, you're able to really experience, in my mind, what it would have been like as a guest here of Mr. Hearst.
Having taken in his tapestries, his art collection, and the entire hilltop world architect Julia Morgan and he built, that titanic tycoon of the 20th century, Mr. Hearst feels just a little more hospitable. For KCRW, I'm Matt Gillum in San Simeon.
Coming up on this episode of Greater LA, you may not know his name, but you've likely seen his face or maybe heard his voice in some of your favorite movies and TV shows. The everyman on the scene. Stick around, we're back right after this.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
More of Greater LA now on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. What makes a great character actor? You know, those folks who pop up in TV shows and movies over and over again. The actors who make you go, hey, isn't that the guy from that other movie, that other show? Well, today, our guest has played pretty much everyone from a punk in The Jerk with Steve Martin to J-Lo's dad on her short-lived TV series Second Chances to a gangster who met a famous and unfortunate end in Scarface, to even a leading role in the movie Man from Reno.
Theoretically, it's a perfect place to dump a body.
Especially if you're going to meet the Running Man. Here. It's right on the way.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
You think it's a coincidence?
No, I just think I'm going to keep you on the Running Man case.
Why?
Because the trail's not cold yet. Dig a little deeper, will you? Besides, there is a connection. It's all the same case anyway.
Today, Pepe Serna is here to talk about another leading role in a documentary about his life. It's called Pepe Serna, Life is Art, which premieres at the Latino Film Festival here in L.A. this Saturday. That's June 4th. Pepe Serna, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Nice to have you with us. When people call you a character actor like I just did, what's your reaction? Do you take that as a compliment? I mean, how do you, or is it just what it is?
All of the above. But I, of course, take it as a compliment. I've been at it my whole life since I was 3 years old. So Yeah. No, I have no problem with it.
You've appeared in so many shows and movies, acted opposite a bunch of big names, from Al Pacino to Clint Eastwood, but yours isn't necessarily a household name. Is that how the documentary came to be? I mean, did someone come to you and say, hey, you know, I've seen you all through the years. I'd like to talk about you on film.
Yeah, that did. It started in my hometown. I go back all the time to do my improvisational workshops. I studied with the famous Dale Close from Second City, who was there with everybody all the way back to Mike Nichols and Elaine May. So yeah, I've been doing that forever. And I do it not just for actors, but for everybody, because everybody is an actor. I tell them, hey, you have to be the best spokesperson for yourself. So learn how to improvise. It's what we do anyway, every day of our lives.
You say you go back to Texas. You grew up in where? Corpus Christi, right?
Right.
I want to play a clip about what you were dealing with early on when you were growing up in Texas.
All right.
One time I remember probably 10th, 11th grade. I was always dancing. I was a good dancer, so I would go to the clubs and stuff. And we went to a new club that opened up, and they wouldn't let me in. And it was because I was a Mexican-American. I was a... What? It had never happened to me, and I was like shocked. So you felt it. You felt it.
You felt it. Now that you said it was the first time that happened to you, I guess you were an older adolescent. Did it happen more than that? Did you feel that when you were growing up in Texas? I mean, you're close to the Mexican border.
You know, I went to a Catholic school through elementary school. So we were all protected because we were all Catholic. So it seemed like we were all the same. But then as soon as I got out of that school, I went to another, to the Catholic high school. But getting out into the world, stepping outside of those grounds, then you saw the real life happening. And one of the ugliest moments I remember is I saw this white boy kicking this Mexican kid's head into a bumper because they were from different high schools. And it just didn't make any sense to me why anybody would do that. Why going to a different school would make any difference. And it is stupid. So yeah, it happened.
It happened.
But I was a, social butterfly. I was out there in all kinds of clubs and dancing and Golden Glove champ. So I did it all.
Did you have eyes on Hollywood growing up?
Oh, yeah, since I was 3 years old.
Three.
I my mother used to take me to all the Mexican movies, me and my brothers and sister. And I loved watching them. You know, it was the golden age of cinema from Mexico. So they were really good movies. And so when I was three, I jumped on to my godfather's boxing ring. And after the boxers left, I started shadow boxing and accidentally knocked myself out on purpose, and went down and got a big laugh. And so I got back up and did it again. And I didn't get a laugh the second time. So I realized, this only works the first time you do it. So you have to be, somehow I knew that, it was in the conscious, this is what I have to do. But then from there, we moved to an all gringo neighborhood when I was six. The doctor next door filmed his daughter's birthday party. So I got to see myself a couple of months later on the screen. So the movie actor was born. So I was never going to be an actor. I was always an actor.
What was your first role when you came to Hollywood? You came to Hollywood when, in 69? Is that right?
69. But my first role was before Hollywood. In Corpus Christi, I played the lead in Jacket of Blood and Gold. It was a bullfight movie.
The 80s come and you play Angel opposite Al Pacino in Scarface. I want to play this one scene.
Okay. Money stays in the trunk till I come out. You got that?
Si.
Me, nobody else. Si. Okay. I'm not out in 15 minutes. Something's wrong. Okay? Room 9. You ready?
Sure.
Ready.
And that's Tony Montana saying, if I'm not out in 15 minutes, something's wrong. And you're going in with him, right? Up to the apartment. This is the drug deal gone wrong. You weren't back in 15 minutes. What happened? And this is obviously a notorious scene in your career.
What happened in the scene is that I get my arms tied up onto the shower bar, and they decided to find out where the money was by threatening to saw my arm off. But being the man's man that Tony Montana was, man, yeah, it's not going to say nothing.
You got chainsawed is what happened.
Yes, I did.
It's awful. It's a terrible, I didn't even want to, you know, allude to it, but because that's such a big part of your career, right? Like playing that role in that movie.
Playing that role in that movie, not that it got me any more parts or anything, but now for all the improvisational workshops that I do across the country and that I've done, that's the calling card. Everybody has seen it. So the kids already, I've hooked their attention because they've seen it.
You were all these character roles, right? You were never the leading man. Were you like, I'm going to bust through and become a leading man? Or were you like, I'm just doing what I'm doing and having fun doing it?
My mantra out there is that I've always hated the idea of the star. When I'm doing my workshops, I tell every kid, hey, we are all the producer, writer, director, and star of our own world. We see everything through our own eyes.
It's Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis, and before you bid us adieu today, we're going to finish the episode looking at a couple of new exhibitions in Los Angeles. You know the phrase, the world is your oyster? Well, one exhibition takes that phrase to a whole new level and gets you thinking about the exploitation of nature. It's called Your Perfect Plastic Heart. It's at Wilding Cran Gallery. In another show, It's Not My Music, the artist Mosey Romney makes the exhibition a call and response. It's not my music, it's ours. And to do that, the artist used a vintage photo archive. To explain, our art insider Lindsay Preston-Zappas is here, founder and editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles, or Carla. Hi, Lindsay.
Hey, Steve.
All right, I want to start with Your Perfect Plastic Heart from Fawn Rogers. Tell us about what's going on here.
Yeah, so the artist makes these huge paintings of mollusks and oysters, and they're kind of in various states of being open. Some of them are closed, some of them are like wide open, some of them are being shucked. Sometimes they involve human hands kind of harvesting the pearls, so you can see that sort of extraction taking place. And then other ones are just kind of beauty shots of the oysters themselves. They're painted larger than life on colored backgrounds. And these ones in particular to me really felt like shrines to the female body. There's this really undeniable fleshiness to them that feels really human-like and sexual. And I think that connection to humans is really intentional by the artist.
What piece stood out to you most? Because it seems like there's, I don't want to say controversial, but I mean, there is something of a sexual nature to these paintings.
Sure, definitely. I think that's super intentional. And, you know, that kind of draws you in. Like, I think these large mollusk paintings are so just beautifully depicted and as you said, kind of sensual, and they really draw you in. But then alongside of that, there's these smaller works, like I said, with humans kind of interacting with the mollusks and extracting pearls, eating them, opening them up. And this series of paintings are painted stills from a two-channel video that's also in the show called The World is Your Oyster. And this piece was a mix of found footage and some shots that Fawn filmed herself. I think this video really kind of hits the point home that we're making a point about extraction and nature. And, you know, I think oysters in particular are really interesting as creatures because they filter and clean the ocean, and yet we harvest them, you know, and we have ways of manipulating them to get pearls. And I think the artist is really looking at oysters in particular for this reason. They've also been super affected by climate change and oil spills and things like this. But I think there's also a political message here about gender and bodies and female bodies. And in light of the, you know, Supreme Court documents, a lot of this is coming up lately. And there was a performance at the opening where two performers actually wore shirts with slogans that said, "My body, my choice." And a percentage of proceeds went to Planned Parenthood from this performance. So I think Fawn is definitely looking at that relationship and making a connection between the ways that we extract from nature, and then this type of legislation that targets women's bodies.
Let's move on to the artist Mosey Romney. Their paintings mix together found photos and personal memories. How do they do that? Is it a collage, something like that?
Yeah, well, they're sort of painted collages. So they're all one painting, but the artist does source from a variety of places. They used to actually work at the Studio Museum in Harlem in New York, and they would have access to this large photo archive that the museum had, and so would just kind of have access to these vintage photos sort of devoid of their context. And so some of the scenes in the paintings are actually pulled from these kind of vintage photo archives. But then they're also mixing in memories, references to the past, references to family members. You also, in a lot of the paintings, see these kind of swirling portal shapes. And I think, you know, there's a lot of kind of magical thinking here, a lot of maybe even time travel going on, where the artist is kind of using objects from the past, from other people's lives, but also their own life, and almost kind of manifesting for a future, manifesting a collectivity that, you know, is more communal for the future.
And they bring sort of a human element, a familial element into it, right? Because there's this large silver bell hanging from the ceiling. What does that represent?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the artist was using a lot of objects that are familiar to us and also familiar to them and their family. So this bell was an object that the artist found in North Carolina, but the artist's grandmother used to collect bells. And so it's kind of this family legacy. And now Mosey themselves is collecting bells and kind of carrying that forward. But, you know, I think bells are also an object that many of us have a connection to in some way or have a similar kind of familial relationship to. And, you know, the bell in particular is really interesting because it has a mirrored surface and it's kind of oversized and hanging in the exhibition. And the artist talked about the bell being almost like a portal that all the paintings around it reflect onto. And so it's almost, again, the bell itself is a kind of portal that speaks to the present and the past and this kind of connectivity.
It's Not My Music is up through June 18th at Nicodeme. Your Perfect Plastic Heart is up now through June 25th over at Wilding Cran. Lindsay Preston Zapp is founder and editor-in-chief of Carla. Lindsay, as always, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
That's going to do it for us today. Next week, if you're a homeowner, you can get cheaper fire insurance if you pay a premium to protect your community from fire. Well, if you're wealthy, you can do that. But if not, guess what? Meet the folks that go around town clearing public rights of way of religious materials all over Greater LA. That's next week on this program. Join us online anytime at kcrw.com/GLA. Share your thoughts with us. Share your story ideas. Even ask us a question. Subscribe to the podcast. It's all at that magical website, kcrw.com/GLA. Jenna Cagle, Juliana Mayo, Rebecca Ludman, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, PJ Shahamit, John Meek, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordall all had hands and ears on this evening's show. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thank you for your ears. Have a great night.